The crash in Roswell. The United States government not being able to explain 143 mysterious flying objects. Are aliens really out there? Or is this just science fiction? Today, we learn more about UFOs. All right, thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More, where each episode we bring you a new story about people, inventions, pop culture, science, and life. Today, we are talking about UFOs. Well, I guess it's UFOs. They've recently changed the name of UFOs. A little bit of a rebranding, I guess. They are now UAPs, or Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. We're also talking about just life in the universe. Are we the only ones out here? I don't know. Well, let's bring in somebody that definitely knows a lot more about this than I do. Chris Impey, a professor and the deputy head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. He's also the author of a couple of books, including The Living Cosmos, Our Search for Life in the Universe. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So, okay, this report comes out from the U.S. government. They released a report on various UFO sightings over the years. At the same time, they started calling UFOs UAPs, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Let's start there. Why the change in naming?
Well, it's a rebranding, as you said, because of the stigma attached to UFOs. I mean, the military are aware, you know, they're aware of the optics of the things they do, and they understand that UFOs have been part of the pop culture now and are associated with, you know, abductions and crop circles and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to, you know, get a clean start with the new acronym. I mean, UFO is pretty anodyne. It just means unidentified flying object. It doesn't right. say alien anywhere in it. So UAP, UFO, it doesn't really matter. But that was their rationale. They wanted to do a reboot, if you like, on
right,
the phenomenon.
Right. Right. Get it a little further away from Bigfoot, I guess. Okay. So what are your thoughts on the report, and what exactly did that tell us?
It told us actually very little. I mean, it was pretty disappointing given the hype and the lead up and so on. They were, of course, mandated to do this by Congress. So the Congressional Intelligence Committees, you know, asked for a report because various videos, as we know, have been leaked. And you know, really, the Pentagon and the military have had pretty much secret UFO study programs for decades, since the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, episodically, they come into the public eye. But this sort of leaking of videos 4 years ago, actually, by the New York Times, that sort of kicked off this recent episode. And Congress decided that not really because of the potential that these are alien spacecraft, but more because of the fact that they could be technologies of American adversaries, that it was a national security issue and that we should get to the bottom of it. So, you know, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence was told to report to Congress, and that's what the report was. But it was very slender. It's 9 pages. Didn't really conclude much of anything.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked at the size of this report. I mean, it kind of actually made me think of like 1947, the Roswell incident. Well, you know, you've got somebody in the military saying that they found this saucer-like shaped object, and then all of a sudden it's a weather balloon. And then later, what it was in the 90s when that turned out to be some sort of spy balloon that we were sending over the Soviet Union at the time. So even that was a small report. It seems like that's part of the mystery behind all of this, or that's part of the, I guess, want for information on all of this is, I guess, the secrecy or perceived secrecy that's behind this. Do you think that there's more information out there that the government's kind of hiding?
I mean, that's sort of become part of the landscape of the conspiracy theory, that the military knows way more than they're letting on.
And exactly.
And I don't think that's the case. You know, they have, of course, been secretive over the years and have been studying this on the sly. But as for, you know, aliens deep frozen in Area 51 or whatever, no, that's not true. So I do think they keep some parts of this under wraps. Obviously, when they're talking about their surveillance technologies and the kind of data that people get flying fighter jets that get to these sightings, some of that's security, you know, some of that's
right.
secret technology that we don't really want everyone to know about. So there's some secrecy there. But I think, you know, they're trying to do they're trying to be more transparent. That's clear with the release of the report. But with 9 pages, they say nothing. I mean, there's no data in there. There's not really much interpretation. There's not the word alien or extraterrestrial doesn't appear anywhere. They only definitively identify one of 144 sightings, and that's just a deflating balloon, weather balloon, if you like, you know, harkening back to Roswell. So it's pretty disappointing.
So this report, why is it important?
They were pretty much told to do this by Congress. I don't know that they would have otherwise. And also they knew that with the leaking of these videos into the media and starting in 2017 and then again in 2020, when they actually had to admit they were real, and then they sort of belatedly said, yeah, these are real. These are Navy videos. You know, they just wanted to get in front of it, I guess, a bit, as well as being told to do it by Congress. Congress's motivation is the national security angle, I think, the potential that these are technologies of American adversaries. And that's a real concern. And the report uses this sort of benign word, air clutter, to talk about the stuff that these pilots are seeing and admitting that it could be a hazard, you know, to these, you know, highly trained pilots and their super expensive planes that they fly. So they have a motivation to know what's going on in their airspace, in our airspace.
Let's talk about non-government, though. You know, UFOs have been in science fiction since the beginning of the science fiction genre. Adding that word fiction, though, to that, I mean, is the science community less likely to look into the phenomenon because UFOs have been classified as fiction or conspiracy theory?
I think, I don't know the best way to put it. I mean, clearly the fact that UFOs have been co-opted by the popular culture in a way that, you know, is really full of conspiracy theories and, like I said, alien abductions and things that just scientists don't give any credence to, that sort of taints the whole subject. So if scientists are looking for an interesting puzzle to solve or an interesting problem to work on, they're not going to go first to UFOs because of all the baggage. That's probably the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's probably a reputational risk for most scientists in working seriously on UFOs because of all that baggage. So that's sort of kept scientists away from serious study for a long time. There have been some academic studies and reports by, there was a Condon report in 1968. There was Peter Sturrock, a Stanford professor, did a report in 1998. So every few decades, there's a pretty serious attempt to look at the phenomena, and it comes back inconclusive. It certainly doesn't come back saying they're aliens. And typically it will come back saying there's a small subset of the sightings that resist easy interpretation. I mean, as you say, the military are not the only people talking about this. And in fact, it would be very bizarre if aliens were traveling across the galaxy and just, you know, with technology you think they would not want to show to anyone since they clearly are superior, and just revealing themselves in this kind of clunky way to one military. Why not to the Chinese? Why not to the Russians? There are other major powers out there. Why is this only being seen by American pilots? That's a little bizarre. So
yeah,
there are thousands of UFO reports every year around the world that are reported to various places just by regular people out there at night or during the day. And that's the longer history of the subject. But most of those are phenomena that we can explain. Half of them, over half, are just simple astronomical phenomena because most people don't know the night sky, or they don't know what Venus looks like, you know, when it's bright and low on the horizon. They don't know whether balloons or behave strangely when you see them on the horizon, for example. You know, people are not expert observers. That's simply the case, especially for things they're unfamiliar with. So, you know, these anecdotal and one-time sightings, they're not very useful for scientists because science is based on replicatable phenomena, something they can study in the lab. How about some physical evidence? You know, after hundreds of thousands of sightings over 50 or 60 years, how about some physical evidence? How about a piece of metal or a chunk of a spacecraft or something that we can study in the lab and everyone can agree that it's weird and non-terrestrial?
That's exactly what I would think. I mean, if they were more, let's say, advanced than us and able to fly a ship here to our planet in near secrecy, why wouldn't they have reached out to us in some way?
Right. It's very anthropocentric. So that, you know, the other reason, the sort of cultural reason that scientists steer clear of it is the whole reporting of the phenomenon. It's very quaint. You know, UFOs still take the shape of flying saucers. That's like so retro. That's like 1950s shiny object from the when cars were sleek and had tail fins and so on. you know, really, can't you boot up your UFOs in the 21st century? So it really hasn't progressed much. And the flavor of the sightings is the same. The part that's about crop circles is simply laughable because those were explained decades ago. There's not even anything to talk about with crop circles. And yet you'll see plenty of stuff on the internet about how these crop circles encode mathematical theorems that we don't have. So they must have been aliens that came, traveled trillions of miles across the galaxy just to press down our wheat and then go home. I don't think so. So, you know, some of it is so laughable that, scientists are just not going to tend to take it very seriously. Now, when the military is involved, if they chose to reach out to scientists and say, you know, there's this subset of reports we really need to get to the bottom of, and if we reached out and had an expert panel, if they did, that might pull scientists in. You know, that kind of framework for studying it might have been more respectable, might actually get some experts be willing to look at these things, at the data particularly.
Right. Well, and I always think too, you know, you said not everybody's expert observers, but everyone's got a camera on their phone now. We have the doorbell cameras, the security cameras, satellites. I mean, you would think if there was something out there that came here, there'd be plenty of evidence and plenty of data to back that up.
And the people who are true believers say there is plenty of evidence. There are thousands of reports here all around the world. And, you know, they can just offer you video after video or, you know, picture from a cell phone endlessly saying, explain this, you know. Well, a single image, you know, grainy image on a low light level on a cell phone, that's obviously very hard to say what it is. It could be any number of things. Just not concrete enough to be interesting for scientific study, really.
Well, there is a lot of study going on about life within the universe other than us. And we're going to talk a little about that when we return. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more Learning More. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. Click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. Thanks for listening and thank you for subscribing to Learning More. I'm Russ and today we are talking about UFOs. Is it out there? We're talking with Chris Impey. He is a professor and deputy head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. He's also written a couple of books, including The Living Cosmos, Our Search for Life in the Universe. So let's talk about that, Chris. What are we doing? What's the scientific community doing to look for extraterrestrial life?
Well, so the scientific study of extraterrestrial life is moving quite well, quite rapidly. And that's what puts scientists in an awkward position regarding UFOs as alien visits. Mm-hmm. Scientists don't deny the possibility that there are intelligent aliens out there that might be able to travel interstellar distances. It's totally possible. They just don't think it's happened. But the progress is pretty impressive. So we've, from zero in 1995, we now know of almost 5,000 extrasolar planets. And just taking those statistics and the subset that are Earth-like planets that might be habitable, they could have liquid water on their surfaces. We don't know a lot about these planets, but you're projecting to a couple of 100 million habitable planets in the Milky Way. And so each of those is a potential biological experiment. We don't know if any actually are. We haven't detected life anywhere else, but we've found enormous numbers of planets that are roughly like our planet. And our planet had life within probably a couple 100 million years of formation. So it's been life on the Earth for 4 billion years. So there's plenty of time for interesting things to happen on these many planets and for that life to become intelligent or develop technology. I mean, that evolution is not implausible. So the science of life in the universe certainly says it's possible that there's intelligent life out there. It's extremely hard to put a number on it because we don't know of any life yet beyond So we have to go in stages. First, we'll probably detect microbes on another planet. And there's a sidebar experiment that looks for, that's called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And that sort of jumps over the whole business of exoplanets and just listens from distant star systems for artificial signals, either lasers or radio signals that a civilization might send through space. And so we've been doing that listening experiment for 60 years with no success, but that's right. going on too. There are active scientific searches for life on planets that we've been finding in large numbers. And then there's this radio and optical listening experiment for civilizations, you know, for full-on intelligent civilizations. And neither of those have had success yet.
So we've got the ingredients for life out there on other planets, potentially. Statistically, does that mean that there's a high likelihood that there is life on other planets?
Yeah. I mean, the trouble with statistics is you can work them both ways. So the statistics of planets are compelling. There are Earth-like planets all over the place. That's for sure. We've measured them. We've seen Earth-like planets. So mm-hmm. it's very close to Earth clones, pretty much. So they have all the ingredients for life. They're going to have carbon-rich material. They probably have liquid water on their surfaces, and there's local energy source from the star, geothermal, or whatever. So, however, that doesn't in and of itself imply there's a lot of biological experiments. It might have been unlikely that life started on the Earth. When you only have one thing, you can't generalize. So we can't take the history of this planet and project it out into space as a chronology. So it might have been, in the end, unlikely that all these chemical ingredients get together and make a single cell for the first time. It might be unlikely that even if you have microbes, you get intelligent life. I mean, remember, on the Earth, there were billions of years with life on the Earth, and it was never bigger than the head of a pin until the last 10% of Earth's history, 500 million years. So if you come back to the Earth for most of the history of life on Earth, you'd see nothing. It would be microscopic life, not very interesting. So intelligent, advanced life, big life, that is a very recent thing, and it took billions of years. Well, maybe that means it's unlikely. Maybe it might take many billions of years normally, and there hasn't been enough time. There's only a handful of intelligent species out of hundreds of millions on the planet. You know, toss in orcas and dolphins and elephants and your favorite smart species, octopus. It's still just a handful out of hundreds of millions of species evolving for hundreds of millions of years. So you could just say, well, that means it's unlikely. That means it just doesn't happen very often. And then your huge statistics of Earth-like planets whittles down to a very low number of intelligent or technological civilizations, and they will then be very thinly sprinkled across a very big galaxy, making the distances ridiculous. And so travel and communication become implausible. So that's one of the answers. You know, they may be out there, but they just may be sparse enough that just we wouldn't see their evidence, and they wouldn't travel, or they couldn't get here.
We're sort of back in a modern, you know, space race at this point. Now it's, you know, billionaires battling it out instead of governments. What do you think that's going to do as far as, or do you think that that'll have any impact on the search for life in the universe?
It's not going to have an impact on the search for life. What it is going to tell us is a couple of things. It's going to tell us how hard it is to live off the Earth. I mean, we've really not tried that at all. Mm-hmm. We did the moon, and that was half a century ago, just for, you know, a few days or a week. We're going to find out as we go off Earth and try and build colonies on moon and Mars in the next few decades, just how brutally hard it is to live in space or in another place that's not fit for life like this planet is. And that presumably is true for other species too. As they leave their worlds, they're going to be faced with that too. The other thing we're going to learn is that it's a big universe. So these little adventures into near Earth orbit, that's nothing. I mean, near Earth orbit is like a half day's drive straight up. That's just really close to the Earth. We've still only been to the moon with people, 12 people, standing on another world. That's a quarter of a million miles away. Well, those nearest stars are trillions of miles away. So the distance to stars, other stars and their planets, is hundreds of thousands, basically millions of times further than going to Mars, which is already hard for us, and we may do it for a few decades. So I think the distances to the stars put in perspective, you know, even this exciting space race that's going on, it's not going to take us out of the solar system. It's not even going to take us to the edge of the solar system. Right. So it's really hard and must be hard for any other species too. It's all about energy and how do you protect a species, a biological specimen, when they have to be in a very inhospitable environment, space, and travel a very long way for a very long time.
Is the Space Force necessary? What are your thoughts on our new Space Force that we've added?
Right. I mean, it probably won't completely go away. I mean, so a lot of people just think it should quietly go away. It's a solution in search of a problem. There's no particular reason for a Space Force. And also, as you alluded to, the excitement in the space race is now all in the private sector. It's all from commercial. Mm-hmm. I mean, NASA's been seen as a little sleepy and unambitious, or, you know, there were 10 years when NASA couldn't put American astronauts in orbit, had to rely on the Russians when the shuttle was retired. So it's not a very good history recently. And now suddenly Elon Musk comes along and he's taking American astronauts to the space station, and Richard Branson's, you know, putting himself in low Earth orbit, and not low Earth orbit, but in suborbital flight. So the private sector is really up the game. And that's actually good for NASA. That's made NASA be a little more ambitious. And they're partnering, of course, with SpaceX on going to the moon, for example, and Mars. So there's a lot of interesting things happening. But as relating to the big question of UFOs and alien life elsewhere, we're not anywhere on the way to answering that question through this activity, because we're still huddled around the Earth doing these little experiments that are still very hard and very expensive and so on. And we're nowhere near venturing out into the galaxy.
Right. Well, so I ordered your book on Amazon, so I didn't get it quite yet when we set up this interview. So can you tell us a little about the book, The Living Cosmos, Our Search for Life
in the Universe? Yeah, it's luckily it's a book that's not been made obsolete by the first detection of life beyond Earth. It sets up the whole search for life. You know, how do we go about looking for life in the universe? What's the history of our own planet? Given that we don't know of life anywhere else, we have to be as informed as we can by what happened on the Earth. But like I said earlier, we can't draw hard conclusions from the chronology of our planet, because it's just one experiment, and it's the experiment that led to us. So you're not allowed to look at yourself and draw a conclusion from your own existence. That philosophers would say that's a no-no. So the book is about how that search is going, how the first planets were found, how we find planets now, how we're going to find them in the future, the possibilities of living in space, and, you know, of down the road of venturing out through the solar system and maybe beyond. I mean, that's sort of where I get to at the end, is the possibility of interstellar travel. And basically, it's exceptionally hard because the energy requirements are just phenomenal.
And that's the thing, like you said earlier, if it's hard for us, it's hard for anybody else out there to get here.
The laws of physics are the same everywhere in the universe. We do.
Exactly.
So the energy requirement part is always going to be there. We are, you know, Breakthrough Starshot is a very ambitious experiment to send little nanobots or little tiny space probes that weigh about a gram and use solar sails to accelerate them to 5% of light speed and get to Proxima Centauri, get to the nearest star in maybe half a century. That's really ambitious. But that's nanobots. That's 1 gram spacecraft taking half a century to get there. That's nothing like a person or a spacecraft with people on it. The energy requirement is multiplied by a very, very large number to get that.
Yeah, you know, I could talk about this all day. This is such a fascinating topic. I actually enjoyed watching some of your Q&As on YouTube.
Well, we do live Q&A because I have an online class, massive open online class, or a MOOC, which is free. It's with Coursera. So you can, if you search on Coursera in my name, there's an astrobiology MOOC, which is, you know, about what we're talking about now, and then plain astronomy one. And we do live sessions on YouTube for those classes, for whoever, and also anyone who just finds out about them every couple of weeks.
Yeah, so, I found out and watched a couple of those, and I was like, you know what? I got to have you back at some point and just kind of delve into the topic of black holes, because I find that fascinating.
Well, that was actually my last book. The one we were talking about is an earlier book. The most recent book I wrote was Einstein's Monsters, The Life and Times of Black Holes. So that's a primer for black holes for anyone who's interested.
Nice, nice. Well, I'll put a link to both of those books and to your YouTube channel and your Coursera class so that people can get more information about it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you. Yeah.
And thank you for listening and subscribing to Learning More. We've got some great topics coming up. I know I say that every week, but guess what? Every week we do. Yeah, I've got a fantastic guest. We're actually going to bring him back for two episodes. Next week, we're going to talk about the Olympics and why like cities no longer want to host this. What's going on with that? And then also, cities are changing, especially with the pandemic. People working from home. Everybody's kind of shuffling about the country, moving to different places. We're going to talk about that as well in the coming weeks. So be sure to subscribe to Learning More. Also, check out our daily podcast, This Is Today, for daily historic events, national holidays, and so much more. I'm Russ, and I'll talk to you next time.